our goal is really to help people get to where they need to get to and not have to change how they work with data necessarily. It's just about reducing the friction they have in working with data.
This is Contributor, a podcast telling the stories behind the best open source projects and the communities that make them. I'm Eric Anderson. I'm excited to have Shashanka Das of the Data Hub project to join us today. Thanks, Shashanka.
Thanks, Eric. It's fun to be on open source podcast, so I'm very excited to be here.
So Data Hub has quite the history. For the unacquainted, they should go watch the YouTube video on the website because I just went through and it's great. But I feel like we're coming on 10 years of your journey here.
Yeah, it's been a decade. It's phenomenal when you think about it. A decade of a lot of work that has gone into the project. It started out very small search and discovery tool that I kind of just petitioned that we should build. And here we are. It's a full-fledged big project.
What is Data Hub maybe today? And then we'll go back a bit and discover all it used to be. But how do you describe it to people?
The best way to describe it is as a metadata platform. There's no other better word for it. Some people take a step back when they hear that and they go, well, can you explain to me what each of those words means? I mean, platform, most people get it, right? It's something that probably provides some sort of a service interface. It's probably storing some stuff that's important and retrieving it back. Metadata itself is kind of a tricky word, right? What is metadata and what's data? That's kind of a very philosophical topic. But for most people, you know, they understand tables and they understand that tables have names. They also understand that tables have schemas and owners and partitions. And then attached to tables are sometimes views. And then attached to those views sometimes are queries that then produce other tables. Once in a while, there's an orchestrator that comes along and kind of reads those tables and writes another table. And then on the other side of that table, maybe there's a BI tool that's actually taking that table and visualizing it in a chart or a dashboard. So really our goal is to take all of these different data assets and data adjacent concepts and stitch it together in one single graph backed by a platform that can allow you to get all sorts of access on it. Like you can store it, you can read it back, you can search it, you can query it as a graph, you can query it as an analytics warehouse, and then you can build a bunch of use cases on top that allow you to achieve whatever you want to achieve with all of this metadata. Tons of use cases.
We haven't said data catalog yet. Is this a data catalog, or is that probably a word we're avoiding because, you know, it means something to some people and different things to other people?
Great question. The data catalog for us is a use case on top. It's an experience that you build or a set of functionality that you build on top of a metadata platform. And the definition of a data catalog is actually has been kind of intuited over the years by just observing products that have labeled themselves as a data catalog versus having a pure definition of it that sustains over time. I actually have a lot of problems with the word catalog when used to describe this category because, I mean, pop quiz, Eric, what is the first word that comes to mind as a synonym when I use the word catalog? What do you think of from the physical world?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. A menu or I don't know.
Most people say that it reminds them of all the junk mail that shows up at their doorstep. And they have all these product catalogs, right, from all these different companies that are sitting there. And in general, a lot of the thinking around this area has been a lot of curation, a lot of effort having been put in to create the perfect catalog for your data assets. And the great fallacy in that thinking is that it assumes and presumes that, you know, your data is kind of like static. There's not much that's changing. And so you can go through the effort of creating a beautiful library-like experience when it comes to looking and browsing through your data collection. And there's nothing wrong with that dream. I think, in fact, it's a great dream to have. But the way in which you go about it really determines whether your strategy will work or not. And for, I would say, you know, the early part of the last decade, we've spent a lot of time and energy as an industry building products that are focused too much on the consumer and the manual curation of it all. So there's a lot of, I guess, clean room governance efforts that have gone into establishing teams of excellence whose job it is to catalog the business data that exists in the company, make sure that it is consumable, usable, and, you know, by the time they're done, the organization has moved on and a lot more data assets have been created, and those are really driving the business. So you're kind of looking at a satellite or a moon from 20 light years ago or whatever, right? And kind of saying, this is what it looks like. So that has kind of given the whole space a bad rep, because similar to data warehousing, it's actually very interesting. A lot of similarity to the data warehousing journey itself, where data warehouse teams, central teams doing warehousing, have often run into this problem, that by the time they have managed to harmonize the organization's data model and make it usable, the business has moved on. And so the same thing repeats itself with metadata if you do it wrong. So that's kind of the reason why I don't try to talk about it as a data catalog, but in terms of functionalities, absolutely, right? Being able to search, find reliable, trustworthy data assets, being able to understand lineage all the way from your operational systems to your analytical systems and then back out to SaaS tools. And not only that, really being used not just by humans, but also by systems. I think one of the biggest failings of this category has been it's over-designed for humans, but hasn't been designed for systems and machines to talk to each other. And so when an AI model is getting served in production, can I quickly make sure that it is actually certified for use? Can I make sure that it's got the right compliance metadata associated with it? It's got the right retention rules that have already been applied. Those are all things that if you don't think through them as fundamentally tied at the hip, you end up funding and building it using different solutions. And then those two systems don't agree with each other. And then you've got kind of a different divergence that you're dealing with in your what you're stating to the auditors versus what your users or customers actually see on the product.
To your kind of naive description where people kind of imagine they can describe everything in a perfect world, I also find that VCs or others will assume a much simpler data landscape in companies than really exists. You know, they'll be like, well, don't they already have a Snowflake? And I was like, well, yes, and they have a Teradata, and they have some BigQuery, and they have, you know, they've got all of the things. You know, a big bank is going to have one or two of everything. And I feel like part of the goal, you know, maybe isn't to arrive at a perfect world, but it's to arrive at a better world where you've corralled the mess that is modern data systems.
Absolutely. I think innovation is going to push companies forward. There are always going to be different teams that will want to have autonomy to choose the best-in-class tool for doing their job. And the organization's job is not to really limit that innovation or the adoption of that innovation, but to try to achieve consistency in spite of it.
So I have a question for you. I wonder how you would think about this question. There's some talk today about how databases are being kind of decomposed. This is mostly on the OLTP side, like Postgres has all these extensions now. But in big data world, Hadoop was kind of a decomposed database by some measure. It was on a file system. And then maybe Snowflake feels like the most kind of fully recomposed database. And now there's talk of data lakes again, and we're kind of decomposing. A metadata platform, is it a component in a larger data system that like could be a component in a composed database? Or is it always something independent that's kind of gathering several different parts?
Great question. I think there's almost two different valid answers to this question. The first almost speaks to the need for a project like this almost, right? Which is that there will always be fragmentation or multiplicity in the data stack. And I'm not even talking about the fact that there will be more than one relational data warehouse that people might choose. I'm talking about even the journey of data itself involves one or two or three systems, because even the act of producing and consuming data involves a bunch of transit points. Even you've only chosen one per stack, right? So that's kind of the simplest reason why you need this thing to live outside. But you add innovation on top of it, And you find that pretty much every segment has two or three tools that are doing something. The segments themselves are coalescing and splitting every once in a while. We see this duality of code and data at rest showing up all the time. Are orchestrators producing data, or are databases storing stored procedures and materializing on demand, right? And a lot of this stuff ends up creating kind of ripple effects. But if you look at it from a data strategist's perspective, and I kind of had that role back at LinkedIn, right? My job was, I was responsible for the entire data platform, and I had to basically make decisions around how are we going to ingest data? How are we going to manage it? How are we going to surface it? How are our AI and data practitioners going to quickly produce relevant and important insights? And I had to make all of those decisions while all of this innovation was going on. Like Hadoop was a new thing back then. Spark was about to be an important thing. And then there were so many other systems being built around that time. And so the only way for folks in that position to make good decisions is to, as much as possible, future-proof the APIs and the policies and the way they think about how these things connect to each other, and leave it flexible about what exact technology they're using to store their operational data, what exact technology they're using to stream their data or process the streaming data. And so when you look at it from that perspective, from someone who has to design a system or a data strategy that's going to survive over multiple generations of technologies innovating and evolving, you come to the realization that some things that are company-specific, business-specific, and that are logical in nature need to stay outside. Because it's kind of foolish to take, you know, the fact that the customer object looks like this, and it has these PII characteristics and things like that. It's kind of foolish to take all of that and then just hard code implement it against a specific database technology's API, even if it supports that capability, right? The ideal way you want to do it, and we see this in software design, right? You build interfaces and then you have implementations of those interfaces, and you try to keep the API and the implementation separate. So you'd have a logical layer where you store all of these logical specifications, like here's what customer looks like, and here's how I want to manage it, and here are the fields of customer. And then you want an operator or something like that that basically takes that logical specification and then deploys it into the specific physical asset. And so we think about metadata platform as kind of two sides of the same coin. The first is visibility, actually being able to see everything that's going on across all of your different systems. And then the second, and this leads into kind of a control plane way of thinking about data, is not just visibility, but actually being able to declare what you want to see happen, not just observing what has happened or what is happening.
Let me take you back to the beginning, because I think your story is amazing, and I'll throw out a couple elements of it. You already mentioned you came out of LinkedIn, and the project was kind of incubated there. The project's grown to incredible levels. 8,000-9,000 GitHub stars, and what's maybe even more impressive, you have more members in a community than you do GitHub stars, which I don't even sure how that happens. And so tell us about how this project's grown, because I feel like it's taken on a life of its own, and you've been there the whole time.
Yeah, so like you said earlier, the project started in 2013. I had just taken over as the architect for the big data team, and I was confronted with a lot of mess, right? Everything was disparate. Everything was being done differently. And the first thing I did was try to standardize a few things like data ingestion, data management, et cetera, et cetera. But even after all of that standardization, I realized that there was still quite a bit of problems that hadn't really been solved. There were people joining LinkedIn at that time and asking questions like, where is this data? How do I get it? How did it even get here? We were at that time moving from a relational data warehouse to a data lake strategy. And people were asking, what's the official source of truth for this table? Is it in Teradata or is it in Hadoop, or which one do I use? Just a lot of questions about where is this data and how did it get here? So that led to actually creating a quick project called Warehouse. The question where and the question how kind of merged together as a single project name. And that was really Data Hub V1. It was called Warehouse. And it was really just a search and discovery portal. And we just crawled a bunch of logs and a bunch of assets and built a quick and dirty search interface to, you know, quickly go and query data and find what you were looking for. And that thing lived for a while, 3 years or 4 years. And it had a few good things going for it. And also we learned a lot of lessons around why even the quality of that metadata being good is important, because people were losing trust in it very quickly because we were kind of scraping it from logs, and all of those pipelines would break every once in a while. And people were like, well, I searched for this, it's not here, so I guess warehouse isn't that good, right? So that was kind of one of the things we were kind of tracking. And then in 2016, GDPR came along, as in the regulation started becoming top of mind for LinkedIn's leadership. And I was given an offer I couldn't refuse, you know, how you get volunteered in a all-hands meeting, and before you've had a chance to actually understand what exactly you got signed up for, you were it. So that's sort of what Igor did to me. He was head of data and CDO at the time. And said, well, Shashanka, you've seen the whole journey of data. You've been part of the online space. You've worked on streaming. And now you pretty much know everything to know about the offline space. And turns out LinkedIn needs to get GDPR right. And we really care a lot about member privacy. So we're going to do it right. And we're going to do it ahead of time. So this was 2016. And I was tasked to be GDPR lead. Even the laws hadn't been fully fleshed out really then. You know, the LinkedIn legal team was still working with. And, you know, there were a lot of back and forth going on around how many of these laws are even implementable using the technology of the day and things like that. So I got really involved with the legal team. But what it ended up doing is kind of reimagining how we were doing metadata in the first place. You know, this crawl approach wasn't going to work. So we ended up kind of completely re-architecting it to be stream first and be kind of like a deconstructed metadata platform where, you know, when the Oracle DBAs are pushing DDL changes to production, they're dropping in events over Kafka, and that comes in straight into Data Hub. Or when a Kafka topic is getting provisioned, or when a Hadoop data set is getting registered, or a Hive table is getting registered. And so it made it much more easier for teams to know what their responsibilities are and what their contracts were with the rest of the organizations. Like, what does it mean to be a good metadata citizen? Well, if you own a system, it needs to produce metadata whenever it changes something. And that led to, I would say, the previous generation of Data Hub. It has actually moved on since then, since Acryl formed. But the previous generation of Data Hub was really event-oriented. That was kind of when we re-open sourced it back in 2020. And then 2021 is really when Acryl got started. And, you know, at this point, Acryl and LinkedIn are essentially have joint governance of the project. So we have, LinkedIn is an investor in us, and, you know, but Acryl is, you know, the main contributor to the project. And we've been really stewarding the project, making a lot of contributions to it, and also bringing in a host of new contributors. So a lot of big companies like, you know, Netflix and Pinterest and Stripe, PayPal, Optum, they're all not just using the project, but actually contributing meaningful features back. And so that's been kind of a great journey. And the community started out on Slack, and it was like around 200 or so when we got started in early 2021. And right now, yeah, we just actually celebrated 10K. So we just surpassed 10K members, which when we started was for us like a dream goal. Like, oh, if we hit 10K, that would be amazing. But yeah, it's been fun.
What do you make of that community size? Maybe it means that the people who interact with the project are really involved. Like, it's not like you have a lot of people who drive by and vote, this is cool, GitHub star, move on. They see what you're building and then they want to be part of it. But maybe you have a deeper insight on what drives the engagement on the community.
Well, there's definitely a few common themes that emerge. First is the system, you know, just installing the system and getting it to work isn't enough. But a lot of people drop in just for that. Like, hey, you know, the usual troubleshooting stuff. Like, hey, I installed it, I was ingesting this stuff and ran into this issue. So that's definitely a large majority of what people are coming there for. But then what they stay for is actually kind of interesting. Because for a lot of people, once they stand up the product and they actually see that, yeah, I can deploy this thing and I can ingest a bunch of stuff pretty quickly, they then start asking the second order questions like, wait a minute, what do you do with this thing? And how do I deploy it? Like, who uses it? How do I get it to the kind of adoption that I read about on the blogs? Like, we know that Airbnb, LinkedIn, all these companies got to amazing amounts of daily usage of something like this. How did they get to that point? What were the strategies that they used? How did we get to the kind of modern data governance capabilities? Can I just keep doing what I'm doing right now get my central data governance team to come in and click some buttons and annotate some columns? And is the tool going to solve all these problems, or do I have to change how I'm doing data to take full advantage of what this tool enables? So that's really what leads to a lot of very interesting conversations around modern data stuff. I mean, there's governance, there's observability, and then there's also just productivity. And that, I would say, leads to a lot of very interesting things. And many of these people are actually then pushing features back or pushing ideas back into the project. Netflix took a look at it and they liked it, but then they said, wait, we can't really adopt it until you've built these things. Like, the platform has to be completely runtime metadata model extensible. And we said, okay, why don't you join forces with us and we can collaborate and design this thing together with you, and then we can build it together. And so that's exactly what we're doing right now. And then, of course, that leads people to stay and build even stronger engagement.
One of the things that open source maintainers have to wrestle with is, you know, what are the scopes and the bounds of the project? What do we say no to? What do we say yes to? And I can imagine that being especially true here. Big community, kind of unlimited scope on things, you know, you could cover. Should we do lineage discovery? How far do we want to go on lineage? And so how have you dealt with that? Have there been tricky areas? Where have you come out and what you want Data Hub to be in the future?
It's definitely a very important problem that we've wrestled with, especially because this product in many ways fills the gaps between every other product out there. It's really about doing the things that these other tools are not able to do among each other. And so the possibilities tend to be limitless, right? Lineage tends to not be so much of a controversy. I would say the biggest two areas where we've gotten quite a lot of interest in building towards, and we've cautiously walked in that direction and sometimes said, not a great idea. The first would be just straight up BI. Like, hey, I'm already looking at this table. Can I just visualize it right here? So that's a common ask. The other one is access management. So a lot of these are essentially next steps after finding something, right? So you found something, what are you going to do next as a data practitioner? You're probably going to request access to this thing so that you can then go query it or access it or do whatever you were planning to do with it. And the way we end up deciding is obviously, I mean, it helps that we have limited resources and limited amount of design bandwidth at the very top. Like, you know, if you look at the main folks driving the project, it's not like we can completely parallelize all of the thinking. And so that helps. But also from a focus perspective, you know, we think that our goal is really to help people get to where they need to get to and not have to change how they work with data necessarily. It's just about reducing the friction they have in working with data. So anything that helps us reducing the friction that they have in accomplishing a data transaction, if you will, where a data transaction could be, I want to get access to a data set, or I want to be able to query a data set, or it could just be, what is the data I need to do my job? So the way we build is always using an extensible mechanism. So you can always connect to the system that is providing that functionality for you. We like to participate in essentially a composable data stack, which means, for example, if you have a data quality tool that you're using, you can plug it in. If you've got an access management tool that you're using, you can plug it in. And those helps us build kind of the right discipline around what the interfaces need to be and what the plugin points need to be. And then over time, the community gets to decide if certain parts of this makes sense to be kind of part of the batteries included section of the platform or not.
How did you go about deciding to build a company around the project? I mean, I think some open source founders almost found the two simultaneously. You started this in 2013, and I think you didn't incorporate until a few years ago. What was the catalyst for that?
I would say the pandemic definitely had a big reason to do it. It's a strange occurrence. But my life at LinkedIn had been extremely productive for the entire time I was there. I was always building something and at the same time creating a net new thing in my whole time there. So there was that hamster wheel of innovation that I was always on, and that kept me going for a really long time. But 2020 is when I was able to take a little bit of a step back because, you know, the pandemic hit, we were all on Zoom, I happened to actually lose a parent at the same time. So I anyway took a little bit of time off to kind of reflect on things that I wanted to do, things that drive me. And when I came back from some of that self-reflection, I kind of felt like I needed to do something of my own. And I also realized that LinkedIn's data team is not going to fall apart if I leave. You know, we have such overinflated understandings of our own self-worth when we are at a place for a really long period of time. I used to feel that same way. But stepping back in 2020 because of the pandemic and a little bit of a break that I took definitely helped me realize that I could walk away and not worry about the team doing well. So that led me to think, what is it that I want to do? What is the change that I want to see? And I continuously kept coming back to this thing. Like the one thing that annoyed me the most about how we were doing data was that we were siloing too much in kind of how we were hyper-solving certain problem segments. You know, data quality and data governance and a few of these other things were being pursued as independent ventures. And having seen kind of the benefits of solving this using that single metadata platform to form that consistent graph made me feel like there was a better way to do things and we could have, as an industry, compounding benefits if we did it in this way. My co-founder, Swaroop, who I had worked with really closely at LinkedIn for many years, in fact, the database that I built there for the online side was actually something that I built along with him, had gone on to lead data at Airbnb after that. And he was leading search infrastructure and knowledge graph stuff there. And Airbnb had also a legendary data team and cloud native data architecture, very different from LinkedIn. LinkedIn was very on-prem. And so we got to talk and turns out he had been noodling on similar ideas and had come to a very similar conclusion because he had run a bunch of initiatives at Airbnb like cost attribution and things like that and had realized if only we had all the metadata in one place, I wouldn't have to solve this problem 9 times. And so we decided to combine forces and build a company around it. Like I like to think about it as, you know, getting the best of, you know, LinkedIn's data infra platform talent and getting the best of Airbnb's kind of product ethos and ability to build delightful product experiences. That's kind of how we started. Of course, we have a team that spans the globe right now and has exceptional people from all kinds of companies.
I mean, it sounds like the dream team. I always think you want to have someone with a high degree of trust, someone you've worked with before, but also has a very different network of resources to draw from. And you hit the target there on that one.
It definitely feels that way.
There's a debate with cloud and SaaS being dominant. Is there an advantage to being open source anymore? You can just create a SaaS product that does more or less what the metadata platform does. How have you and your customers kind of arrived at the value of open source?
That actually does come up quite a bit in kind of how we think about what we put out in the Data Hub project and what we keep commercial and also kind of when we talk to our customers and ask them, why did they choose us? And like I, of course, I'm a builder. And so I have a very skewed perspective on a lot of this stuff, right? Because I want to see the code. I want to know that the thing that I'm going to be using, I can actually understand how it's built. But even for organizations that are not built like that, we definitely see the desire to not be locked in have such a strong kind of resonance. Because like I said earlier, a lot of the things that you put in Data Hub are really your company's crown jewels, your semantics around what is this thing? How does it look? How does it relate to other things? Besides, of course, getting all of the metadata in and all of the operational metadata in. And so for a lot of our companies, they really want to have that ability to work with something that's going to be an open source standard, that's going to have longevity beyond even the one vendor that they're starting to work with. The other thing that I've seen come up repeatedly is the fact that we are open source allows a few of our customers, not all our customers, but quite a few of our customers, to actually move the project forward in the direction they needed to go. For example, PayPal wanted access management to be a thing. And Acryl, as a smallish startup, basically said, great idea, but we're busy doing X, Y, and Z in our roadmap, which you also need, but we could partner with you and guide you through that implementation and you could just contribute it to the open source project. And they did exactly that. And now the access management or the access request capability is now in open source Data Hub and it's also in the Acryl Cloud product. And we've had multiple customers actually do that. A lot of customers work at the edges. So integrations are a huge part of the metadata complexity problem, right? Being able to connect to pretty much anything you have in your stack. So we have a lot of our customers actually contributing those improvements back, and that helps the next customer. So we see a lot of advantages of that pattern. But then even deeper inside the core of the product, we've seen a few of our customers actually contribute stuff back. And that makes customers feel a lot more in control of their destiny. We've heard stories of customers essentially being told, oh, this is a good feature request, but you have to wait 6 months or a year before we can put it on our product roadmap. Whereas in this case, they're able to actually make those changes with our consultation, but without having to wait for a ton of product development from our end. So that's definitely given us a lot of velocity advantages and trust advantages.
Yeah. What's the future hold for Aquila and the project, or maybe kind of shifting gears a little bit to something more forward-looking? If people hear this and want to get involved with either the company or the project, how can they do that? And what would you have them look forward to in the years to come? And maybe actually let me overload this question with one more idea for you. We haven't talked about AI and generative AI yet. I think a lot of people are tempted now to kind of pivot the roadmap more around generative AI or AI in general. And I can imagine a data catalog or a metadata platform being tempted to do that. Where have you kind of come out and, you know, do I stay true to vision or kind of capitalize on the opportunity of the moment?
Yeah, so that actually ties into DataHub's positioning and its future as well. At LinkedIn, what was one of the interesting things we had done with DataHub was pointed it not only at data and BI style problems, but also at AI problems. So LinkedIn's entire MLOps infrastructure was actually built on top of DataHub. You know, model reproducibility, model discoverability, feature engineering, metadata, all of that was stored and represented in DataHub. So it was actually not at all a surprise to us that when we looked at the emergence of AI and the hyper-focus on, well, let's just do AI, everyone, right? Like, we have to do AI. Most of the teams get stuck on, wait, what data should we use? What is the semantics of this data? Can I actually build my model on top of this? Or can I build my prompts on top of this? Is this the right trust signal? And so in terms of our future, we absolutely see ourselves supporting the emerging AI stack. It's actually one of the top requests, both from the community and our customer base, to index and store and represent ML models and features and all of these other AI assets in the same metadata graph, because these are all connected. You know, a metric and a feature and these are all connected, and you want, in fact, even more understanding of why did this model perform well and what was its performance over the last year? And is this still in production, or is this something that someone tried and tossed away? So we absolutely see ourselves supporting the emerging AI stack. It doesn't feel like a pivot at all. In fact, ML models and support for the Google Knowledge Card stack was actually added to DataHub in 2021. So we're just kind of starting to lean into that muscle because people are pulling that stuff out of us more now. But in terms of how we think about DataHub, it's really cementing and solidifying its foundation in the industry as the de facto metadata platform, and starting to see more control plane use cases pop up where people are able to register their definitions of data products, and they're able to actually see those data products get deployed into production using DataHub as the definitional layer. And Aquila, you know, is basically taking DataHub as the platform and then building opinionated experiences on top of it. That's essentially accelerate time to value, they accelerate time to collaboration, they accelerate time to getting your data under your control by, you know, having friction-free governance experiences and things like that. So it'll continue to be that symbiotic relationship, which is as DataHub, the platform, gets better and more capable, Aquila Cloud, the opinionated offering, just gets faster and better. Since you asked how can people engage with the project and learn more, honestly, best way is just join the Slack community. It's very simple. Just go to slack.datahubproject.io and you'll get a quick form and then you'll just get signed back in.
Great. I think on the AI stuff you were talking about, it seems to me there's kind of three levers to good AI. And one is the algorithms. You know, people talk a lot about transformers or, you know, this or that. But the other is volume. And I think that's honestly what's driven a lot of the improvements of late have just like OpenAI has just ramped up the data size in ways we never really imagined. And then the third being quality. And I think that's the third lever that nobody's quite touched yet and that everyone's waking up to is like, we don't need, you know, 70 billion parameters as much if we can dial up the quality. And I think both the volume, like managing quality at scale feels like it could be a metadata platform sweet spot. I don't know if I'm thinking about it the right way, but maybe the market's moving in your direction, Shashanka.
Absolutely. We see our role as kind of dual. First, being a ledger of all activity that's happening that's of interest. And the second, of being the importance meter. So being able to give you the important stuff that drives the value on top, like facts and then insights, if you think about it more simplistically.
Super. Thanks for joining us today for the discussion. And congrats on all you've done, but also thank you for this awesome project. I think one of the cool things about doing these open source conversations is we get to like appreciate the fact that you've given something to society.
Yeah, it definitely is one of the biggest things that drives me. Anytime someone comes in and installs the project and says, I love this project. This was so amazing. And then they say, but, and then I have this small problem. I'm like, okay, that's validation right there. Because at least you love the project already, and then you have small problems. But yeah, it's been a great journey. Honestly, it keeps a lot of the engineering team motivated as well. We actually do on-call rotations where the entire Acryl team actually is on call for the community. And we do community marathons where we stay on a Zoom call for like 6 hours every month. And so that kind of stuff, the kind of validation and the love you get from the community, it just keeps everyone going. So it's just a super virtuous cycle.
You can subscribe to the podcast and check out our community Slack and newsletter at contributor.fyi. If you like the show, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, I'm Eric Anderson, and this has been Contributor.